Opening bell in about 20 seconds. Let me just set the stage for you.
Money, money, I want more money.
You cannot have it all.
This whole system is too confusing.
Hi, I'm Ben White, and this is Politico Money. Alex Panetta is the editor for our brand new Politico Pro Canada, joining us from Montreal. Alex, thanks so much for joining us, and welcome to Politico Money.
Thanks so much.
We're going to dig into some of the fine print of the newly agreed to United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, the new acronym for what was once NAFTA. And we're going to talk a little bit about how China plays into all of this. So the USMCA, Alex, includes a provision that requires any country in the PAC to give 3 months' notice to other parties if it's entering into trade negotiations with a non-market economy, which the U.S. considers China to be. This seems directly aimed at the Chinese. Is this essentially a loyalty test in this deal?
I'm not sure if it's so much a loyalty test as an extra hurdle for any country to clear if it wants to sign a trade agreement with China without American consent. And of course, you know, this same provision applies to the United States as well. I mean, theoretically, Canada and Mexico could pull out of a trade agreement with the U.S. if it were to sign an agreement with China. But the way it's being perceived by some people in Canada is a bit of a loss of sovereignty, that, you know, some of our trade policies been farmed out to the United States. Now, there's the counter argument to that, of course, is that, well, any country could leave NAFTA at any time, or the USMCA any time it wants to. So it's not entirely clear how this really changes that.
Gotcha. All right. So let's talk, before we dig in any further, on whether this thing is actually done, because I saw your tweets this morning suggesting that it actually isn't, and there are details to be worked out. What are those, and could they still potentially kill this thing?
Yeah, so I don't have great visibility on the details themselves. Apparently, some of them relate to autos. But what I'm hearing is that the Canadian government is telling people that, no, there's still a couple of things that need to happen to make this thing a done deal, a little bit beyond the traditional legal scrub. No major issues. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, figuring out the rules of origin from scratch. There's just a couple of fine print details that need to be worked out. So to say that the NAFTA negotiations are completed is incorrect, that there's still negotiations happening, but on a much, much more limited level. The idea, of course, was to get everything completed by October 1st, right? The negotiators were in a hurry because they wanted to meet this U.S.-imposed deadline. The result of that is that you've got some typos in the text, which is, you know, not completely abnormal for a trade agreement done in a hurry, but also the fact that they left apparently a couple of gaps.
So the big picture on this, a lot of the commentary following the agreement between Canada, Mexico, and the United States was that this is not a great departure from NAFTA, and a lot of it is similar to language that was in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which the Obama administration tried to put forward and failed, and then the Trump administration scuttled that. When you think about this and how different it is from either the old NAFTA or TPP, how do you think about it? How different do you think this is?
So I'm of two minds. Okay, on the one hand, you got to give Trump credit for having achieved a few things, even things that President Obama didn't achieve. For instance, biologics, right? Getting a 2-year extension to 10-year protections for U.S. Biologic drug makers. That's something that was extremely important to Orrin Hatch, obviously the powerful head of the Senate Finance Committee, and he achieved that. That was not in TPP. The auto rules are significantly different. Now, whether that's a good thing, they might end up driving up the cost of cars, but that's an achievement. I mean, a number of things. Online duty-free shopping. Canadians can now buy $150 worth of goods without paying duties when buying stuff from the United States online. That's also new. There are a whole bunch of different things that the United States achieved. Most of them, you're right, were in TPP, and most of them are tweaks from the original NAFTA, but it's on many, many fronts a better deal for the United States. Now, on the negative side, none of this is groundbreaking. The long-term impact could wind up being a slightly closer to the negative side of the ledger in that people are angry. People in Canada are extremely upset with the way the president handled these negotiations. So if you go around achieving a slightly better deal for your country, but in the meantime antagonize lots of people and also possibly create rules of origin for cars that make it more complicated to build a car and more expensive, have you really reinvented the wheel here? Have you really done something great for your country?
Yeah, I want to ask more about that. The level of kind of anger and frustration among the Canadians with the United States and with President Trump having kind of thrown the whole NAFTA agreement into question for over a year and a half. And obviously we can talk about the aluminum and steel tariffs that went into place as well and are not solved entirely by this new agreement. It sounded at the end like Trump and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau were kind of getting along a little bit, and you wrote extensively about that. So it felt a little bit good at the end, but talk to me a little bit more about how kind of frustrated and angry the Canadians are that it came to this, that we came to this 11th hour need to extend NAFTA.
So sometimes it's important to understand the present. You look a little bit at history. And so Secretary of State to JFK, Dean Rusk, I think had one of the best observations about Canada-U.S. relations I've ever heard. And that's Canadians want two things at the same time. All right. They want, on the one hand, to be recognized as independent and free to make their own decisions. And on the other hand, they want to be part of the U.S. Team. They want to be under the tent and sort of have this special relationship. That sometimes is in conflict with itself, those two conditions. In these NAFTA negotiations, Canadians were pushed around and made to feel that they were not independent. They were going to be bullied into a deal on the one hand. And on the other hand, they were made to feel that they're just like any other country. And, you know, you're going to get steel tariffs because, you know, under national security provisions, you might get kicked out of a trade agreement with us. We'll maybe do one with Mexico without you. So all these things are happening at once. At a time when the President of the United States' approval numbers in Canada are, you know, somewhere between 11 and 20%. He's exceptionally unpopular in Canada, right? So when someone people don't like comes in and tells you, I'm going to bully you, I'm going to take stuff from you, you've been too good, you know, you had it too good, and I'm going to change things to my advantage, not yours, you can imagine that leaves a bit of a scar. And the rebuilding effort from this, I don't think is going to happen overnight. A lot of Canadians are going to remember this.
Why does that matter over, you know, the medium or long term? I mean, if this deal ultimately gets done and gets through Congress, presumably next year, and we have, the USMCA in place, what's the difference if the Canadians feel pissed off at the Americans? What could be the outcome of that?
Well, the thing is, the countries cooperate in so many different areas, and sometimes the United States needs Canada. I mean, if the Canadians change, for instance, their pharmaceutical rules to allow for cheaper drugs, and that creates a black market in the United States, security cooperation. You know, Canada's got a couple of missions on the go for NATO. They cooperate on a whole bunch of areas, from cybersecurity, border, like data sharing of people who cross the border in order to sort of better track people who might be a threat. And I'm just naming three or four, but they're like literally, you know, thousands of ways the countries cooperate on a daily basis. Some of that stuff needs political will in Canada. Now, another example, missile defense, right? The United States would like Canada to spend some money on a new radar system to monitor for incoming missiles from Asia over the Arctic. This kind of stuff requires Canadians' consent. And it's hard to get that consent when people are extremely angry. And I'll give you just one example of how that sort of played itself out in, you know, not too distant past. You know, Canada was asked to join the missile defense system in 2004 or 5 under George W. Bush. People were so upset in Canada over the Iraq invasion that at the time, even if it might have been in our interest to participate in this thing, people said no. And the government of Canada, which was inclined to say yes, had to say no because of political pressure. I bet you had, you know, Barack Obama pushed Canada to join missile defense 5 years ago, Canada might have said yes. A lot depends on Canadians' views and feelings and attitudes towards the United States. And right now, things are not great.
And do you have a sense for what Trudeau really thinks about Trump?
Let's put it this way. When Trump was first elected, Justin Trudeau created a rapid response unit within the Prime Minister's office to deal with, like, exclusively with Trump-related issues. It's basically like a campaign war room. Now, the Canadians don't like the term war room. They think it carries negative connotations, so they call it the friendship war room.
The friendship room, I love it.
Government bureaucraties, yeah. So basically, this unit is responsible for just monitoring any crisis of the day and responding to it. More often than not, the response is to not say anything. Don't overreact. That's basically the general rule of thumb within the government, which is exactly what happened last week. All right. So, you know, the war room springs into action when Trump starts, you know, blasting Chrystia Freeland in Canada. The decision comes from on high. It's take it easy. Don't say anything. It's all good. So essentially what you can glean from that is that, you know, Trump is seen as an issue to be managed in Canada.
seem to be an issue to be managed just about everywhere across the globe. I mean, I'm picturing these Canadians in this friendship room waiting for the Trump tweets to come out and desiring very strongly to react in a sharp way and then having to kind of hold themselves back and say, let's wait and see what actually happens, then react to what he does, not what he says. I mean, how do you view this thing, like what these people are doing?
Well, okay, I'll just give you an example of how he plays in Canada. So the Conservatives, okay, the opposition party, was kind of worried that Trudeau would not get a NAFTA deal and then campaign against Trump next year. There's an election in just exactly a year from now. And so there's a belief now that Trudeau lost the ability to use this issue domestically, that now he's got a campaign on his record. And the issue's kind of turned around a little bit, where now the Conservatives are saying, you caved to Donald Trump on, you know, pharmaceuticals. You caved to Donald Trump on the non-market economy clause, the China stuff. You caved to Donald Trump. You caved to Donald Trump. And that's what you keep hearing now. And it's just interesting that the fact that conservatives here see Donald Trump as someone you want to negatively associate someone with. All right. And so essentially that speaks volumes about where our politics are, where the conservatives are using Donald Trump negatively here.
Yeah, that's fascinating that he's toxic to conservatives in Canada. Shows you the sharp differences between kind of where conservatives are in the United States versus Canada. Let's talk a little bit about the Trans-Pacific Partnership versus the USMCA. And obviously, proponents of the TPP argue that not only would it have updated NAFTA between the United States, Canada, and Mexico, but would have included a much larger group of Pacific Rim nations to present a united front with the Chinese. And an analogy I like is the way the TPP worked was the carrot approach: create a new trade zone with rules that favor the United States and other members, and then ultimately induce the Chinese to join on those terms. The way the new NAFTA works is more like Trump threw the carrot away and now he's using the stick. Is that a good way to think about it?
I think that's an excellent analogy. And that, you know, the carrot was an effort to get the entire neighborhood around China to sign an agreement that had clauses limiting the power of state-run companies. It created rules for data flows and privacy protections, but basically forbade countries from insisting on data localization. So this is obviously, I mean, this was an attempt to create a blueprint that someday China would have to live under, to sort of project the Pax Americana onto the Chinese doorstep and to try to bring China into the fold eventually. This is a different approach. This is to, you know, put on the brass knuckles and beat up on anyone who dares to do things in a way that the United States does not like. Yeah, is it going to work? I don't know. I mean, it could. You know, the United States got a better agreement, I think, in many ways from Canada. And so Donald Trump deserves credit for that, again. But over the long term, does this benefit the United States? I'm not sure, because it does create some ill will.
Yeah, I mean, it feels sort of like, you know, Trump's attempt to get some of the benefits from TPP without embracing what he hates to embrace, which is anything that Obama did. And not that TPP would have gone forward if Hillary Clinton had been elected president. She came out against it on the campaign trail. But, you know, it does feel sort of like an effort by Trump to recreate TPP and just call it something else. And for that matter, to keep NAFTA by just rebranding it. Is that kind of the way you look at it?
And you know, like I actually think that the TPP process is probably not completely dead. I've heard an interesting theory here, and it's actually a theory that I think is supported by the fact that Donald Trump himself has gone out and said he'd like to join TPP. Of course, that lasted about a day and a half.
Yeah.
But so the theory is, one of the big American concessions in TPP was over autos. All right. It basically allowed much more Asian product into the North American market. And so this theory is that you take the auto rules under NAFTA at some point, the new ones under the USMCA, and you take them to the Japanese and say, OK, fine, we'll re-enter TPP, but under these auto provisions. Now, I'm not sure whether this is a stretch. I'm not sure whether Japan would ever go for something like that. But if you basically took those auto rules and twinned them with a TPP, you might end up having, in some ways, the best of both worlds, right? Auto protections for North American workers, still the sort of the carrot approach, a return to that carrot approach. Whether it ever happens under a Trump presidency, I don't know. But a lot of people think it makes a lot of sense for it to happen someday.
Interesting. Well, let's get into autos for a second, because it is the provisions in the USMCA concerning autos are among the more controversial, particularly in the automotive industry in the United States. And these are the requirements that, in order to qualify for duty-free auto exports between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, they have to have 75% North American content. And there are also new wage requirements. And the concern is this is going to drive up costs for automakers and ultimately perhaps increase the price of automobiles and also drive jobs overseas out of the North American zone, which would be counter to what is hoped for here. What do you think is the likely outcome of these new automotive rules?
So on the one hand, I think Canadian auto workers probably owe Donald Trump a favor, right? Because these new auto rules have probably ensured a longer term stability in the auto industry in Canada by driving up this, you know, the sort of the wage guarantee. So basically 40% of a car, right, has to be produced in places with a $16 wage. That is great for Canadian and American auto manufacturers and for auto workers. That's on the positive side of the ledger. And also, by the way, so they've just started breaking ground on this new Gordie Howe Bridge between Windsor and Detroit. That's going to be the major hub, the major artery for Canada-U.S. auto trade. And one of the points that Prime Minister Trudeau made at the groundbreaking ceremony was that, you know, this bridge is important. It was always important. It's even more important this week than it was last week because we have this new NAFTA agreement. So that's on the positive side of the ledger. On the negative side of the ledger, so some analysts, the Center for Automotive Research in Detroit, they looked at the NAFTA provisions or the USMCA provisions in their preliminary form. Okay, so this study that they did is a few months old. But their study found that, you know, these rules would increase the cost of a car by hundreds or even thousands of dollars and essentially acting as a multi-billion dollar tax and hurting sales because people keep their wallets shut, if the car costs an extra $500 or $1,000. So is this a good, again, is it a good thing? I think one of the big mistakes people make when they analyze a trade agreement is they try to make a decision about whether something is good or bad, right? Is this good for Canada, good for the United States, good for dairy? With, you know, forgetting that for every single issue, there's a consumer and there's a producer. There are, you know, buyers and sellers. And to say that this is good for autos, well, it's not great for someone buying a car. Same thing for dairy. In Canada, people are saying this is bad for our dairy industry. Very sensitive feelings about this in Quebec, right? I actually think the Canadian government would never have made this deal on dairy 15, 20 years ago when Quebec's separatist movement was stronger. This is where dairy, this is the heartland of Canada's dairy country, and it's very, very polarizing and have very strong feelings here. Anyway, people talk about a loss for Canadian dairy, but Canadian consumers, people who buy dairy, which is almost everybody, might get a better deal at the grocery store and more selection. So I think that's the challenge of assessing a trade agreement is, you know, it's not a binary thing, that there are multiple dimensions to every single aspect of it. And so is it good that Canadians and Americans will probably have more stability in their auto production for years to come? Sure. Is it great for people buying cars? Not so much.
Yeah, it's a very good point that these things are never binary, and you do have to look at the impact on both producers and consumers, and it's a complex interplay, and I like the way you've articulated that. We talked about milk already to a degree. Let's just go back to, I think, what you mentioned first, which was pharmaceutical companies. Are prescriptions going to get more expensive now as a result of this?
I think slightly. I think there's a, so basically, you know, very expensive biologic drugs had an 8-year protection in Canada. They're now going to have 10. So that's going to maybe change things a little bit. The big game in town in Canada is going to come up in the next few months. The Canadian government's making a few decisions on drug pricing. One is how you design the basket of reference prices. You just look at this, you know, other countries' drug prices, and that's how we make our decisions on, you know, the pricing of pharmaceuticals. There's some talk about maybe removing the United States and Switzerland from that basket, which would obviously make drug prices cheaper in Canada. I know that some Americans, and especially the pharmaceutical industry, are very worried about that. There's that. You know, there's also a conversation about a national pharmacare plan in Canada. What does that do to drug prices, and how does that affect the industry? So those are really the big issues. Biologics is important, but it's not as important as what's probably to come. Those big debates are happening right now.
You know, the Canadians have attempted negotiations with the Chinese in the past and haven't necessarily gone that well. Tell me a little bit about that relationship.
So the Canadians, for years, actually dating back to Justin Trudeau's father, have always talked about trying to diversify Canada's trade relationships. You know, you don't want to be reliant on one bridge or one hub for your national prosperity. I think, so 75% of Canada's exports go to the United States, all right? The United States' exports to Canada represent a much lower part of your GDP. While still important, you know, the United States sells more to Canada than a whole bunch of other trading partners combined. That being said, the dependency is stronger on the northern side. So for about 40 years now, Canadians have looked at this and said, okay, how do we kind of break out of this this addiction, right? We need to sort of find new markets. And Pierre Trudeau tried it. I heard every single subsequent prime minister talk about it. Stephen Harper tried it. And now Justin Trudeau is trying it. And the idea is, you know, they've been exploring free trade negotiations with China for, well, basically since he entered office. And it didn't go that well the last time he was in China. Basically, the Chinese were in no mood to be lectured to by the West, and Canada was talking about some progressive provisions related to human rights, labor rights, et cetera, et cetera. The Chinese don't like being lectured to by anyone, not by the Americans, and certainly not by the pipsqueak northern brother, as they might see it. And the Canadians are pretty adamant that if we're going to enter a trade agreement with China, we want to have certain conditions. And that, I guess that takes us back to the conversation we're having at the beginning, where is the West better positioned to negotiate trade agreements with China when working together or working separately?
All right. Before we go, let's just pull back the lens a little bit and talk about how you see the rest of this playing out now that we essentially have, you know, the agreement in principle, although some items still to be negotiated. The idea is to have a signing ceremony with the three leaders in November and then have the deal submitted to Congress after that. Presumably, it would hold over in the U.S. until the next Congress is seated in January. How do you think this is going to go? Do you think that signing ceremony happens in November? And then walk us through what you see as the future for this.
So we're not getting confirmation of that yet, but I suspect that November 30th is probably, I think it's probably going to be on. I suspect, I don't see any reason they wouldn't do it November 30th, just before Lopez Obrador takes office. In Mexico. So you know, you do that signing ceremony in November, things get quiet over the holidays, and then in 2019, the attention shifts to Congress. I actually think you probably also have a lot of questions after the midterms, like in during the lame duck, people will be asking Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who knows, what the Democrats are going to do with the USMCA. Likelihood of her answering directly, I'm not sure if it's high. She might decide to punt it into 2019 and deal with it later. So I really do think that the drama, you know, we're going to arrive at high noon sometime in midwinter 2019. And whether the Democrats decide, or if they're in the majority in the House, would the Democrats decide that they're going to pass this new USMCA or not? If they are hesitant in passing this, and if they fight it, then the question is how the White House responds. There is a risk that President Trump goes completely Rambo on Congress and basically says, you pass this thing or I'm going to blow up NAFTA. Your options are not a new NAFTA or an old one. Your options are a new deal or nothing. That's essentially his greatest source of leverage. I think it was his leverage with Canada, frankly. I don't think Canada would have signed this agreement with some of the provisions in it had they not been afraid of tariffs and the absence of a trade agreement at all. That's his leverage. If he starts to use it, you're going to see a lot of panic. I think, you know, it'll affect a lot of things, including in Canada, the Canadian dollar and stuff like that. So, you know, it's the short answer to your question is I don't know, but it's going to be very dramatic.
Yeah, indeed it is. Now, let me leave you with this question, and that is the Reaction among the Canadians to the renaming of this thing and sticking the U.S. at the front of it. You know, when I hear USMCA, I think of the Village People and YMCA, you know, and there's the, you know, you just let Trump be Trump, let him rename it, and fine, you know, we'll go ahead with that. But did the Canadians care that, like, this used to be NAFTA and now it's this, you know, Trumpian formulation of USMCA, or does it just make no difference?
I'm not entirely sure Canadians care about having the U.S. being placed first. I think Canadians probably find it a pretty silly name. I mean, you like having vowels in the middle of anything you pronounce, right? It's a natural instinct in our language. So, and think about this. So a trade agreement that is designed to increase productivity within a trading block, its very name has added three extra syllables to the pronunciation, wasting untold hours of productivity across the continent just saying the name of this thing. So you know, USMCA as opposed to something that could have taken up, you know, just one syllable or two. Anyhow, that being said, I think people will live, even though I think the Canadians might have thought that it would have been more logical to put Canada first and have something that's called the CAMUS, or to borrow a name from my French existentialist author. And some people thought that might have been appropriate given all the angst of the last year.
Yeah, there's nothing that Trump likes more than French existentialists, I think. I mean, he's a, you know, leading scholar in these things. And if you were to try to pronounce it, how would you do it? Is it Ozumka? What? I mean, you can't do it. It's impossible.
It's impossible. USMCA. There you go. So it takes 5 seconds to say
yeah,
it instead
that's
of
the only
one.
Way to do it. Yeah. Well, maybe we've made acronyms great again. Alexander Panetta, editor of Politico Pro Canada, a superb reporter and journalist who are very happy to have him on the team. He's a super busy man these days. Read his stuff. Follow him on Twitter. Alex, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
We're lucky to be joined by Owen Churchill. He is U.S. correspondent for the South China Morning Post, which now has a content sharing agreement with Politico. Owen, thanks so much for taking some time to be with us.
No problem. Good to be here.
So let's talk about the USMCA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement that's just been agreed to by Canada, the United States, and Mexico. Includes what appears to be a provision aimed directly at China, essentially a loyalty test for Mexico and Canada and anybody else who wants to enter into this agreement, not to deal with non-market economies like China. How is that being viewed by Beijing?
Well, we had a period of silence following the announcement of the deal. It was the Chinese national holiday, which might have explained the delay. Though, of course, they responded, you know, within a couple of hours to Pence's speech last week. So I wouldn't put too much importance on that. I think what we saw was on Friday, a spokesperson for the Chinese embassy in Canada came out with a fairly strongly worded statement saying that they condemned this, what they called a hegemonic act that was damaging the economic sovereignty of relevant countries. And I think reading between the lines, what the way that Beijing sees this is effectively, well, related specifically to this clause, they view it as not necessarily a multilateral clause, but an imposition by Washington on Canada and Mexico in a way that harms their own decision-making powers. So they didn't name names, just in the same way that the USMCA didn't name China in that clause, but they're pretty angry about it. But I would say that the delay and the fact that this came from a Chinese embassy spokesperson rather than an op-ed in a state media outlet or from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs itself probably suggests that they don't want to make too big of a deal out of this. They want to respond, you know, they always have a perfunctory response when they view that there's been a miscarriage of justice in any sense. But they didn't come out all guns blazing, which suggests to me that they kind of want to brush this under the table. And of course, you know, there's going to be a long time before this actually is implemented and it has to get ratified by all three parties. So they might just kind of hope that this brushes by and that there's, by the time it comes into effect, there's been substantive progress on the China-US trade front. But we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I want to get to the idea of potential progress on the trade front, but just sticking with the USMCA for a minute, the so-called new NAFTA, outside of that one provision that seemed tacitly directed at China, what has been the reaction of the Chinese to the fact that this agreement was made? Obviously, it's short of the Trans-Pacific Partnership that the Obama administration had proposed as a counter to China. What do they think in general of the USMCA?
Well, I think in general terms, you know, again, there hasn't been an official response. But in general terms, I think they'll view this as part of a broader approach by Washington to kind of box in China, in addition to the so-called veto poison pill clause. There's a clause about currency manipulation that a lot of people are viewing as a kind of blueprint for further free trade agreements going ahead. Obviously, the US is in conversation with Japan and the EU at the moment. So alongside negotiations with Japan and EU to initiate reforms to the WTO, for example, an uptick in military tensions, Mike Pence's speech last week, which was, you know, received very, very angrily by Beijing, and then other areas such as humanitarian pressure about the whole Xinjiang crisis. I think that the USMCA is really just one part of a broader approach to Beijing, and I think that the Chinese government is kind of onto that. They were, I think, fairly optimistic about, obviously there are no specifics, but there's been conversations about deals with Canada, and Trudeau has articulated that that there was, you know, there was a hope to deepen trade ties with Beijing. But yeah, we'll have to see whether or not any progress can be made on that front now that there's been this new development in North America.
Yeah, I mean, you referenced a couple of times a speech last week by Vice President Mike Pence, who was very aggressive against China and has emerged as a little bit of the, you know, the bad cop, the public bad cop in this whole Trump administration trade war with the Chinese. And it certainly got people in the business community worried that there is no clear a path forward to negotiations between the United States and Beijing to get out of this tit-for-tat tariff battle. Do you see a path forward there? And if so, what is it? It doesn't seem like there are high-level talks planned right now, but perhaps there are new developments that you can tell us about.
Sure. The sense that I get is that we've had a series of moments over the past few weeks where we've thought, oh, actually, it looks like there might be a breakthrough or at least a coming together of high-level officials. The last prospect of that happening was a few weeks ago, and that was obviously scuppered when the U.S. went ahead with tariffs on $200 billion. Mike Pence's speech, as you said, also put the brakes on that, and I think that we've heard from a senior official, administration official, on the sidelines of the IMF meetings that there aren't going to be any high-level meetings between Steven Mnuchin and Liu He, as some people had forecasted. So I really think that the uptick in rhetoric from Washington is damaging the prospect of any resolution in the near future. I think we heard from the Chinese ambassador to the U.S., Cui Tiankai. He spoke on NPR, and he said that as far as Beijing is concerned, they're frustrated that there doesn't seem to be a coherent stance when it comes to Washington's negotiating strategy. There are different people talking at each stage, and there are different demands being floated. And he, you know, he repeated the mantra that Beijing is willing to negotiate, but we need to have consistency. And then on Washington's side, they're saying that, well, yes, the Chinese are nominally interested and willing to negotiate, but they're not actually bringing any meaningful concessions to the table. So that's the state. That's the status of the impasse at the moment. And you know, speaking to former USTRs and other former trade officials, I've got the sense that this administration, that lack of consistency is its downfall in terms of the US-China impasse. And that's the sense that I'm getting, is that people are kind of tiptoeing around the Oval Office, and it's the power really is in Trump's hands. As things currently stand, he has not given any indication that he is pursuing an imminent resolution to the trade war.
Yeah, indeed it doesn't. And that leads nicely to my next question, which is, I think that Trump believes that he can simply win a trade war with China. The Chinese will ultimately capitulate to all of his demands on the theory that the Chinese export more to the United States than we export to China, and therefore theoretically have more to lose. There are plenty of people who think Trump thinks about this wrongly. How does China think about that? How does Beijing think about that?
Well, I think the most telling indication of their stance is the fact that they haven't bent at all at any stage of the escalation. There's been a series of ramping up of the tariffs. Trump spoke during the announcement of the USMCA. He spoke with great gusto about the power of tariffs and how it was tariffs that had brought about progress with Canada and Mexico. But so far, that hasn't worked at all with Beijing. Beijing has not been fazed by the very, very costly tariffs. And I think that Beijing is doing what it can to amplify voices of opposition within the US or within the US business community in China, who are saying that tariffs are not the approach, they're not the correct approach when it comes to addressing the grievances of the US administration. I certainly think that the change in direction from the US administration to a broader and potentially more painful strategy of looking at different channels through which to exert pressure on Beijing, that's when we might see, when those start coming into effect, that's when we might start to see a more substantive sign that Beijing is concerned about the trade war and the fallout from it.
Speaking of alternative channels that the United States might pursue, the Chinese certainly have alternative channels that they can pursue beyond simple tariffs on American exports, right? I mean, isn't it true that Beijing could make life pretty difficult for U.S. businesses trying to do business in China?
Yeah, that's right. They've said publicly, at least, that they don't intend to pursue the so-called qualitative measures, the non-tariff barriers. But there is a sense amongst the U.S. business community in China that, at least according to a recent survey by the American Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai, there is a sense that there has been an uptick in non-tariff barriers to business operations. So that includes an increase in government inspections, making the licensing process more arduous, various measures like that that Beijing has at its disposal to make business difficult for those U.S. companies. Wang Yi, the state councillor and Beijing's top diplomat, went on the record towards the end of the previous week when he said he was in New York for the UNGA, and he said that he denied any existence of Chinese policies designed to make things difficult for US companies, and encouraged any US firms with grievances to pursue legal judicial channels within China. But there is a sense, I think, amongst US companies that the environment in China is changing. Whether or not it's going to increase remains to be seen.
What does winning a trade war look like for China if they, go head-to-head with the Trump administration on this, and there are the back-and-forth tariffs and belligerent talk from the United States and, so far somewhat muted response from Beijing? But longer term, if we think about, the winners and losers in a trade war, what does winning this look like for the Chinese?
Well, I think that China is taking the approach that they don't necessarily want to win the trade war. They don't see it in a win-loss sense, perhaps in the way that Trump does. Trump sees things through a very binary lens. If he wins the trade war, it means Beijing is lost, and he wants to get concessions, and he's willing to pursue any number of weapons in his armory to achieve that. As for Beijing, I think that they are probably aware of the fact that they are going to have to make substantive concessions, although they've done a pretty good job at protracting this over a good few months. But I believe that we might see from the IMF this week, we might see signs that actually the trade war is going to have more of a damaging impact on global growth than economists have been saying up until now, and the pain is likely to be felt within China in that respect. So I think that this impasse can only go on so long, and Beijing is going to have to offer up some serious compromises. They speak a lot about their willingness to negotiate and to enter into bilateral dialogues and to operate within the open trading system as prescribed by the WTO. Obviously, measures taken by both sides do not abide by that rule book, but at least nominally, China is willing to try and pursue a resolution that the global trading community can accept.
We'll let you go after this one, but I wonder to what extent saving face matters here for the Chinese leadership, in the sense that they, as you say, realize that some concessions will need to be made to bring an end to this, and that there could be damage to the Chinese economy from it, and yet at the same time do not want to be seen as simply capitulating to the bully Trump in the White House and, you know, being victimized by a Trump victory lap and tweets about how he beat China. How much does that play into this, that it would be difficult for Chinese leadership to simply, straight up capitulate?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I think the concept of saving face is sometimes overplayed by Western observers or punditry, and yes, it is an important element of Chinese politics and business, but it's not the be all and end all. And I think that President Xi Jinping is facing a fair amount of pressure from within his own constituencies in China to bring an end to this. By and large, I would think that Xi Jinping will ultimately say, we're going to need to make some quite substantive changes to our trade policy and the way that we engage with the US for this to blow over.
Fascinating perspective from Owen Churchill, who is U.S. correspondent for the South China Morning Post. We will certainly talk to him again as this very tense situation plays out between the United States and China with no clear endgame in sight. Owen, thank you so much for taking some time to be with us.
Thanks, Ben.
That's a wrap for this week's Politico Money. Thanks to my producer, Jenny Ament. And our executive producer is Dave Shaw. If you're liking the show, please do subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Rate us and write a written review. We'll be back with you next week.